Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
But first to the political junkie, Ken Rudin, who is headed to the Twin Cities this week for the Minnesota State Fair. I cannot wait till you get here, Ken. That's exciting.
I am so excited.
You're not just making that up, are you? You are excited.
God, are you kidding? I've been all over social media.
Man.
Matter of fact, I've had over four people like my comments, including me.
Are you really bringing Nixon political buttons with you?
I am going to have Minnesota trivia questions, and I'm going to bring Nixon buttons, political junkie buttons, NPR buttons, including some Carl Castle buttons, some Humphrey buttons.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no, I'm all prepared.
Great. This is great. I'm going to have some swag for audience members who can stump you, okay?
Ooh.
So, yeah, this is going to be a two-way street on the swag, so I'm glad you're bringing some stuff. Okay, questions
Who's the first raccoon elected governor of Minnesota?
That would be the NPR raccoon, of course.
That's correct. That's
questions correct. For Ken about President Trump, Congress, politics here in the Midwest, anything that happened over the weekend. Here's the number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Again, political questions for Ken, or you can tweet in. It's at Carrie NPR. So, Ken, we are at 11 o'clock today. We're talking about whether Minnesota holds the key to House control for Democrats or Republicans, because we've got these seats that could flip either way. What do you think of that argument?
Oh, I think that's very true. Aside from California, because there are at least six or seven Republican seats in California that went for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and Democrats are excited about. Minnesota basically could go either way, because there are definitely two vulnerable Democratic held seats, one by Rick Nolan up in Duluth, the Duluth area that he's giving up. One that Tim Walz is giving up to run for governor. But there are also two Republican seats, the second and the third, where the Republicans could lose that as well. So again, Democrats need a net gain of 23 to take put Nancy Pelosi back in the speakership. It may not be Nancy Pelosi.
Iffy,
and
right?
That's another argument altogether.
Yeah.
But there are two seats of both Democrat and Republican that everybody's watching very closely from Minnesota. And that could determine ultimately who controls the House in November.
Since you brought up the Nancy Pelosi thing, she seems now to have be feeling a bit of the pressure and to open the door to some kind of transition, quote unquote, between her or a bridge or something. How do you read that?
I heard her say that, but obviously, look, she feels that even though she's 78 years old, and again, I don't want to play the ageism card, but, you know, in a party that is looking for new leadership, it's hard to make the case that Nancy Pelosi, who's 78, and Steny Hoyer, the number two, who's 79, and Jim Clyburn, the African-American congressman from South Carolina, who's number three, is also 78 or 79.
Wow.
There's a lot of talk about, you know, maybe we need somebody new. And that's why somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that primary she won in New York's 14th district, That won over a lot of people around the country because they were very excited about it.
You know, you and I have talked about this before. It just seems that this may be one of the few jobs in the United States where you get it and you feel entitled to hang on to it for decades and decades and decades. I mean, I think a pretty good argument could be made to open the door to some fresh thinking, right, and new people. You're not indispensable. These politicians have a hard time accepting that, I think.
Well, that's very true. Look, Nancy Pelosi grew up as a political animal. Her father was mayor of Baltimore. Her brother was a congressman and mayor of Baltimore. She's known politics her entire life. She also feels that because she is a very good fundraiser, and she's an excellent fundraiser, she feels, why throw me out? But again, we've seen, you know, at least in the last, during the, even the Obama years in 2010 and 2014, the Democrats took a beating both in the, in those two midterm elections. Now, if they don't, if they, the Democrats, don't take the House in November, my guess is they still have a very, very good shot of doing so. But if they don't, she is definitely gone. There's no way in the world the Democrats will stick with her as leader. But even if they win the majority, the only problem is, who is the alternative? They once upon a time, they were talking about Joe Crowley.
You mean for
the
Speaker?
Democrat from Queens. The Speaker.
Okay.
Joe Crowley, but of course he lost to Ocasio-Cortez.
Right.
So there's really no obvious. And Jim Clyburn, again, the African-American congressman from South Carolina, who this week said, or last week said, that he would entertain possibly challenging Pelosi, or just running if she doesn't get the 218 votes needed to become Speaker. And that we've never heard from Clyburn before. But again, he's also in his very, in his very late 70s, and that may not be enough for many
Ken,
Democrats.
You know, if it became, if she really, it became clear that she was willing to step aside because she believed that it was time for some fresh thinking, who knows who'd decide to run? I mean, for the moment, it's risky to even raise your hand and say, I want to run against her.
Oh, yes, it is risky to say that you want to run against her, but it's obviously not risky for many Democratic candidates to say that they are not going to vote for her should they be elected in November. We saw that with Conor Lamb in Pennsylvania. We saw that with Danny O'Connor in Ohio if he wins not only the special election, but he's running again in November. So there are a lot of young Democrats who say that, you know, they owe nothing to Nancy Pelosi, and they feel that they're very open to new leadership. And she says, fine, bring it on. I mean, it's not as an arrogance, but she said, look, I don't want to step in. I don't want to be the impediment to anybody getting elected to Congress. If they want to run on an anti-Nancy Pelosi ticket, that's fine with me as long as there's a D at the end of their name.
Let's talk about what the president has been saying about this New York Times story that broke over the weekend about the White House lawyer. This is not Trump's personal lawyer. This is the lawyer for the White House, Don McGahn, testifying or doing interviews with Robert Mueller for the Russia probe. Here's what the president tweeted among a number of other tweets over the weekend. The failing New York Times wrote a fake piece today implying that because White House counsel is misspelled, Don McGahn was giving hours of testimony to the special counsel, again misspelled, he must be a John Dean type rat. But I allowed him and all others to testify. I didn't have to. I have nothing to hide. Can you give us a little bit of political clarity here on is the White House spinning this because now they've kind of lost track of what McGahn might have said? Or could this indeed be true, what the president is saying?
Can you just remind me who John Dean worked for?
That would be Mr. Nixon. And Mr. Dean is Mr. Dean is out there tweeting quite a bit these days, I see.
Let the record show that Kerry Miller said Richard Nixon's name before Ken Rudin.
And before the week is over, probably will many times again. Yeah.
Anyway, Don McGahn is the White House counsel who has said many times that his role is to protect the presidency, not Donald Trump personally. And God bless him, because that's exactly what a White House counsel is supposed to do. But there are numerous media reports that said that he fears that Trump is setting him up to take the blame for what happens should Mueller have more and more information, because, as you say, he has testified over 30 hours, or at least talked to Mueller's investigators for over 30 hours this year. So McGahn says, look, if you're going to set me up, I'm going to just be very honest. And because the White House did not declare attorney-client privilege, McGahn felt he was compelled to testify. So between what Michael Cohen knows, his former personal attorney, and what McGahn, the White House counsel, knows, Trump is scared. And we saw over the weekend with Rudy Giuliani testifying, it's clear the White House has no real absolute knowledge of what McGahn actually said. So for Trump to say that, well, I let him do that, and thank you very much, I'm responsible for allowing him to do that, the White House is very scared what McGahn knew, because he was in on all the, you know, the efforts to, you know, to get Jeff Sessions to do certain things to get rid of James Comey. He is the keeper of the secrets. And if he tells Mueller everything he knows, and again, who knows what that is, there's a reason for the White House and Giuliani and Trump and everybody else to be very nervous.
Here's the graph from that story, because this is kind of confusing with the back and forth from the Times story. Mr. McGahn and his lawyer, William Burke, could not understand why Mr. Trump was so willing to allow Mr. McGahn to speak freely to the special counsel, and feared Mr. Trump was setting up Mr. McGahn to take the blame for any possible illegal acts of obstruction, according to people close to him. So he and Mr. Burke devised their own strategy to do as much as possible to cooperate with Mr. Mueller to demonstrate that Mr. McGahn did nothing wrong. You know who one of the sources of that story sounds like to me? Mr. Burke. I think he's one of the people telling the Times, this was the strategy and this is what we were concerned about. So it's not like, I mean, you know, you're directly to the people involved and their perception of what the president was doing.
That's absolutely true. Plus the fact that two of Trump's early lawyers, John Dowd and Ty Cobb, urged complete cooperation with the Mueller investigation, at least before they brought on Rudy Giuliani. So if you go on throughout that article, it just shows that maybe the Trump defense, the Trump defenders made a serious mistake in cooperating and not fighting tooth and nail as Giuliani seems to be doing now. But whatever it is, there, I think there was a reason for the administration, the White House, to be nervous. And by the way, there was a, I thought of you immediately.
Why?
There was a column in the New York Times this morning headlined Nixon, Clinton, and Trump. I don't know if you saw that. I'm sure you saw that.
Uh-huh.
But let the record show that I thought of Kerry Miller immediately.
Mark says on Twitter, Trump tweeted that he allowed Don McGahn to fully cooperate. Did the White House counsel need Trump's permission to testify? Do you know whether that's true?
I do not know that. I kind of read, though, the fact that the attorney-client privilege was waived, and it just seems like then that McGahn felt that, well, if they were not holding him back, that gave him the opportunity. But I don't know if Trump himself, I don't think Trump really understood what was happening until it was brought forward to him, especially with the New York Times article that he initially dismissed as fake news.
Speaking of fake news,
go ahead.
Wait, when you say you don't think he really knew what was happening, you think it's possible the president did not know that over these weeks McGahn has been giving testimony to Mueller? Could that really be?
I don't think he did. I don't know. Either he didn't know or he certainly didn't know the extent of what McGahn talked about and how long he talked. But it just seems like it's pretty startling that the White House counsel spent all that time, all those hours talking to the Mueller investigators without the president knowing. But I still suspect that could very well be possible.
Ian asks on Twitter, is it smarter for Democrats to run moderates for these coming couple of years? Good question, because you and I have talked about what it's going to mean if Democrats end up with control of the House, managing that caucus, right, of a lot of people with a lot of different Democratic stripes.
You know, remember when the Republicans took control of the House in 2010 and you had first John Boehner, then Paul Ryan trying to get all the Republicans in line, you know, the moderate conservatives, the social conservatives, and the far right conservatives. It wasn't easy. That is a good question. But as we've said on your show many times, that we've seen, especially with Conor Lamb's win in Pennsylvania and Danny O'Connor's near win in Ohio, that one size does not fit all. So with the Democrats, so you could have the Ocasio-Cortez, the more progressive socialist even Democrats running in districts. There's Ayanna Pressley, who's running in Massachusetts' 7th district next month in a primary, very left-wing Democrat. But again, in a seat that are historically Republican, you can't run a left winger. I mean, just to say that, you need to obviously fit the district. I think that's what the Democratic strategy is, that there's no litmus test. You can even be pro-life. You can be X, Y, or Z that may not fit with Democratic dogma. But if you win, you win. And so there's going to be a whole bunch of different kinds of Democrats coming to town after the November elections, and whomever runs the Democratic caucus in the House is going to have his or her hands full.
Speaking of coming to town, it's Ken Rudin on Thursday at the Minnesota State Fair. I'll see you there, dude. Can't wait.
Do people know to bring me buttons? That's part of the deal, right? Did you tell them that?
Yeah,
bring
did you
Ken
see
Ken Rudin campaign buttons?
Hey, did you see me tweeting at you with your just so obviously pathetic request for Pawlenty 2018 buttons.
Bring plenty of buttons, I said. I didn't say bring Tim Pawlenty. I said bring me plenty of buttons.
You know, the buttons that will never be passed out, but possibly were made. Pawlenty 2018, very rare.
Bring me Karl Rolvag buttons.
Is that what you want?
Doesn't matter. Everything. Elmer Anderson, everything.
I'll see you at the fair.
See ya.
Ken Rudin on Thursday on the first day of the Minnesota State Fair.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.